So our next speaker is Bob Ferguson. I believe, Bob, you met Richard Rose back in the early 90s?
91 or so.
Okay, yeah. 91 or so.
Something like that.
And he did move to the farm at a certain point, and much like our other speakers, kind of threw himself wholeheartedly into this path. And AA was a big part of his work and getting in touch with kind of an inner child that came through. Bob is a photographer, and that was one mode that he used to kind of get in touch with this childlike longing to want to return to something, and art and dream work and trying to move back into something that he felt. Sean Nevins, who's also a filmmaker, recently did a documentary on Bob, and it's called Mountain Pine. It's very good. I highly recommend it. And Bob talks about the feeling of when he was, to correct me if I'm wrong, taking out one of these old-time cameras and trying to capture what he felt staring up through the trees, and a longing, something that felt like he remembered but was out of touch with. And I feel like that longing is something that really comes across in Bob's teaching, and was certainly what drove his path. And in 2002, I believe, 2001 or so, had a realization and found what he was looking for. And Bob, to this day, is a photographer and a nature lover.
Well, thank you. And the music to that video is really good.
Is it?
From the heart.
I wanted to try something just a little different, just to see what would happen if we looked at this from the angle of emotion and trying to find our way back to an inner direction through the, let's say, the jungle of our inner emotions, and to look at emotions instead of couching it as thoughts, but to look at it just from a different angle there. I'll try something a little different. I like to talk about nostalgia. I even have my photography art came up with the Nostalgia West term, which I think gave a really good feel to the stuff I was trying to do with photography. I think nostalgia, as I see it, is a longing. It's a deep longing. And I like to define it a little bit and say that it's not sentimentality. We're not looking for memories. I like to say it's not the granddad sitting on the porch rocking in his chair drinking root beer with the grandkids, It's more of the heartfelt remembering inside of a better place, a better time, something that we can still relate to, but we can't quite get our finger on it. I like to say that in this true sense, it's a valuable tool in finding our way to that mysterious place called within. It can be a GPS for the soul, a compass that can give us a pointer into this nebulous thing down there called the heart that we might not know much about. Some of us come on by accident and see that there's something there like that. How can this nostalgic mood help us to discern a true path inwards as being a compass to discernment in terms of thought? How can we discern between different emotions, and how can we use nostalgia as a way to find ourselves through the jungle of all these emotions? It can help us to see that there might be a better place inside of us than we can go within, that something that's a little more real than the dualistic things that we run into every day. There's something that doesn't have opposites in it. Nostalgia is deeper, and I think can be a tool of discrimination in this inner land of moods in the emotional center. we talk a lot about, you know, the thinking, but how about, you know, what are you feeling in terms of dualistic emotions? How does this work in not only in your dreams, but in waking life? We can look for the dreams in there. You know, for dream work, I did quite a bit of that. And one of the most important things was it for me was to look at what was the mood of that dream. Can I remember what the mood was? What's it trying to tell me? Is that a mood I can relate to something I'm doing during the day that I'm not aware of? Can I look back on that? Help me figure out what's going on with this. Now, nostalgia is, to define it, I'd say one way of looking at it is it's a desperate longing. We can remember it. As the longing just starts becoming more and more refined, as we start realizing that there is a thing called the heart, and then nostalgia is pointing there. It's not pointing back to a specific memory, a specific mood, something we've learned. It's talking about something that's in us all the time that maybe we've forgotten. And we don't know where it went, what happened. You know, how do we get here? It's a... also be called a thread back to our source, an emotional thread we can find back into a better part of ourselves. I'd like to talk about this in terms of a couple of personal stories. Maybe I'm sure y'all can all relate to this. We were talking in the Denver group a while back about, can you remember the event or the time, how old you were when you lost your innocence? You know, what happened? You know, and we had varying answers about this and varying ages, and people were defining it different. But I remember when one hallmark for me was in about the fifth or sixth grade. And up until that point, my little gang I was hanging around in were pretty innocent, and we were just bopping around in the woods and stuff. And then this funny thing started coming through like a mood. And it was a bullying and meanness of a certain sort. We would all get together and find somebody in the group and pick on them. And it was very exciting at first. It was like, ooh, there's this new thing. You know, we're going to pick on you and call you names and do this stuff. Until it was my turn. And then the group turned on me. And then I saw, oh my gosh, this is what the other side of that looks like. It's not exciting anymore. It's horrible. And it became very sad, too, because I realized that this was affecting us. It was coming through. We were different. We weren't the innocent kids we used to be. And I saw how easy we fell into it, how quick this would come over and turn us from relatively innocent into, you know, little nasty kids who could really hurt each other. Another one that happened, too, was... about the time I was in eighth grade, and we had a science class, and I had doing a book review on Einstein, and I could pick up on what he was saying. I could pretty much understand it. And I was giving the book review to the class and looking around, and I realized there were only maybe one or two other people that were paying any attention to what I was saying or picking up on it. But the thing that was important about it was that a year or two later, puberty hit, and that went right out the window. I no longer had the clarity of mind or the attention span to hold on to something like Einstein. You know, I was just drugs and hormones, you know. And so what happened? You know, what changed? We see these changes happening to us as we grow up, and we're leaving something behind, and we're losing track of something. It becomes that more like dog eat dog, but with ever-changing rules. You know, how are we going to get through today? I've got to figure this out in a dualistic sense, where before it was spontaneous and you just got through life. You didn't have rules that you were getting from outside. You didn't have to figure out, what does the book say? What do the people say? What does society say? You just knew. But you gradually lose track with all of this. Richard Rose said through looking at his dreams, he realized that there were three basic moods. There's a dualistic pair of them. You've got acquisition or seduction, which is a positive one, and the negative one, which is fear. You've got acquisition, which is going towards wanting to get things. And you've got fear, which is running away from things. These are the dualistic basic moods that run our life. And we bounce back and forth between the two of them. We go from fear to desire. Then we don't want to lose what we've acquired. We don't want to be bothered, so we run away. But we're stuck on this baseline between these two in life, and there's no way out. There's nothing better there. Now, he saw the third mood was what he called nostalgia. And nostalgia being the one that can lead out of that baseline duality of fear and acquisition. The nostalgia can get you out of that. It actually leads somewhere. That's why I think it's so important. It's the one that gets you out of the dualistic, you know, good, bad, up, down, front, back. He also defined, this really struck me when he said it, I can't remember what the context was, but he defined guilt as being a mixture of nostalgia and fear. And I thought, now how is this possible? But the way he explained it was that the guilt is made of nostalgia and fear. The nostalgia is the longing for the relatively innocent state we had before we committed the error that started the guilt. The fear is the fear of the consequences, what's going to happen when we've committed this error. So if you look at this from another point of view, you can see how our life can kind of go along and end up in this this period of guilt. The act that brings on the guilt, let's say, is losing our innocence. We fall into what might be called relative error. Now, the relative error is usually growing up. We come into the adult stage where we've got to figure things out, back and forth, left and right. And then we get into this nostalgia, we get the guilt. The nostalgia says, hey, you were at a better state, a relatively better state before this error occurred. And the fear is, what would be the consequences? Is this just going to keep getting worse? Is this just going to keep happening? So you split this up, you can see where the nostalgia can help here. Let's look at this from when we were innocent. When we were an innocent kid, we had what you might call a pure consciousness. We had a consciousness that was spontaneous and not involved in obsession. We didn't have to have rules. We didn't have to have books. We didn't have to learn things from anybody as to what do I do today. Well, you just do it. You know, you're just out as a kid running around. There's none of this stuff happening then. This consciousness gradually becomes more and more clouded over, and we lose it. And we don't remember where it went and what happened to it anymore. All we know is that, you know, something's not as good. The nostalgia might bring us back to saying, well, I can remember that a little bit, but I don't know. We get more and more to an adult, and we lose that pure consciousness. We get to the point where we've lost track of it almost altogether. Now, a lot of us get into this work because of we get miserable. And we get in here, I know I did, I got in because I was suffering. And I wanted to find a way out of the suffering. And there's a lot of details, you know, with a lot of us, each has their own story. It might be alcoholism, it might be family problems, it might be whatever. But I heard Bob Harwood say that 70% of the seekers get in because of misery and 30% because of curiosity. I think it's more like 90-10. I can't imagine having a curiosity that would carry you through in this more than just a little ways. You know, you've got to get to the point where you're on the mat and you don't know what to do. But if we get to the point where we're that miserable and we want to find a way out, we might have what you could call pangs of conscience. Something might come through and say, hey, buddy, you know, what are you doing? You know, why are you living the life the way you're living it? You know, what the heck is going on? These little pangs of conscience that come through, and I'm talking about conscience in the Gurdjieffian way where that there's a conscience that's universal that doesn't change in the ages. It doesn't change according to society. You know, nowadays society pretty well says, you know, there is no conscience, pretty much. Do what you want. But there's a universal conscience, and that's tied to you individually. But you have these little glimpses of this conscience, and what that is the last remaining link to that pure consciousness that you had as a kid. Those little pangs of conscience are your last remaining thread back to that pure consciousness as a kid. When we had that pure consciousness when we're children, I think we also had what you might call a potential. That your blueprint was in that consciousness that you had when you were innocent. And it contained everything you needed to know to get through life for you as an individual. I think we've all got something we've got to do here. And I'm not talking about, oh, we're all going to become enlightened, but what are you going to do? You know, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, what are you going to do with your life? Why are you here in a manifestation? You know, and I think we used to have a link to that. We knew what it was, what it could be. But we've lost track of that when we lost track of the purity. So the pangs of conscience, which can lead us back to consciousness, can also lead us back to say, we're going to have a link back to what's my potential. You know, what can I be doing? You know, what am I good at? What can I be doing? And have I lost track of that? Am I doing what, you know, people told me to do? I can remember when I got into college and I thought, you know, I'm miserable and I don't know why. I hate college. I just couldn't stand it. I didn't want to go to class. It didn't make any sense to me. I was like, why am I doing this? And I found out when I dropped out and I decided I'm going to go backpack the Appalachian Trail. I don't know where that came from, living in Louisiana and going to LSU, but I sold everything and looked it all up and went and did it. And it was just like, oh my God. You know, for some reason or other, this works where that other thing didn't work. But I had to get really miserable before I had, you know, the idea that I've been told all my life that I'm supposed to go to college. So I did it, and I just couldn't stand it. And then the sooner I got out of that mindset, the more I could get back to a feeling that that the sun had come out, that I wasn't living in the shade, in the dark anymore, and that there was some sort of actual hope for the manifestation. I wasn't completely trapped in the misery anymore. So if we can remember through nostalgia a longing that sends us back through all the other angers, guilts, resentments, all the other emotional mess we might have down in there. For me, it's a pointing back into something more simple, something that's more pure, that can give you a guideline is to where the emotional dualities are that you don't want to get hung up in. Now this can have a strange effect, because I remember when I would first start getting hits of this, it would have a horrible effect. It would usually lead to weeping and shame and trauma, because it was showing me how far off base I had gotten. You know, where had I ended up? Oh my God. How did I get so far off on one end? So it's not all games, and it's not imagination. You're looking for something that's a better feeling inside that you're looking at and you're discovering. It's not something you're imagining that you're going to think is all wonderful. I think that we can use emotion and nostalgia in terms of a meditation practice. That we can use it in the same sense that we want to sit and watch our thoughts. We can sit and watch the emotional moods. I used to do my meditation while walking. I used to walk miles and miles in hiking, and I had the opportunity, and for me it gave my body enough to do that it would leave me alone so that I could meditate. I couldn't sit still. You know, I haven't stayed the same weight since I graduated high school because I exercise. It's just because I can't stop. So moving to me would put all that chatter to sleep, and it would give me a chance to actually look at stuff. So I could walk in all over the mountains there where I live and could start looking through the emotional minefield that was inside there. And what is all this stuff in there? Instead of watching thoughts, I found I could watch moods, and I could watch which mood would come through. When I'd be going up a trail, usually the first moods that would come up would be anger and resentment, because I was mad as hell about work. You know, and then after I worked through that and got through that, then I could drop down to a lower level and find out, what's down below there? Well, I feel like I wish I had this, or why did that happen? And I could look at those moods. And eventually, I could get into a spot where things were relatively clear. But I think you can use this as an emotional technique of meditation, just like you can looking at your thoughts. And using nostalgia as the guide in terms of longing. You know, the way Rumi talks about it. Another thing is knowing that when you're looking at things like the nostalgic mood or doing any kind of meditation, is to be very careful to watch how you allow the mind to grab a hold of these things. If you look at nostalgia and you find that in that mood, and you find a nostalgic mood, it can be very, very sweet if you don't have too much obstacles to it. But what we'll do is the mind will tend to grab that. It'll grab any experience. I noticed this in Douglas Harding when we do Harding experiments. If you catch on to it and you go, oh my gosh, I really get this. I see what's happening here. And then the mind will grab it and say, hey, been there, done that. I know what this is about. I'm going to reference this back into a memory, and I'll never have to do it again. So you fool yourself, and you think, I'll never have to meditate or do this again because I figured it all out. You don't realize that you need to do these things for the first time, every time, as if it's the first time. This is what people can get lost in mental imagery. We can mistake the mental memory of something for the actual act of doing it. We can very much confuse this, and you can spend years being lost in this, thinking that you figured it all out because you did it once, and then you dropped it. Now notice this with a nostalgic mood. You keep coming back to it as if it's the first time you've ever done it. You don't ever get to that jaded point of thinking that, you know, I don't have to do it again. I know what it's like. You see this with a lot of the non-dual crowd, the oneness, you know, that they figure out the concepts and they can talk about it, but that's as far as it goes. You know, they don't want to come back into it again. So this emotion is a real thing that hits you. You don't reference it after you've given up on it. A little trick I like to say is think about what nostalgia can lead you back to. If you go back before puberty, you hit a really relatively innocent stage. You know, it hit before we got into the adult stage, the hormonal one. And oh my gosh, you know, what a better state. Can you remember that? Can you get an emotional feel for what it was like before you had to get, you know, affected by hormones and dualistic, you know, junk and life in the world? And then think back even to when you were a little kid. What was that like? What was your consciousness like then? How did your mind work? Were you free of obsessions? Did you have a time when you weren't, you know, having to like think through everything? And then eventually you end up running back into when you were a baby. What does a baby do? A baby doesn't have to do anything. A baby has no sense of being a doer. He doesn't sit there and say, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, and everything's taken care of. You know, you think the old saying, let go and let God, well, a baby's got that down. He doesn't have to worry about any of that. That stage is kind of what we're aiming at, you know. So we're not the doer, we're not the one who's responsible for this stuff, but yet it's happening. And we become so important. You know, look at me, I've got to carry all this weight on my shoulders, and I'm doing this, I'm doing that. But look at the little baby, you know, that's where nostalgia can point to. Point you back to that innocent state before, you know, you got lost in this, I'm Bob, and Bob has to do all this stuff. And then get you back into that. I'd like to get you guys involved in this, and if any of you've got any kind of remembrance of a nostalgia mood, or if you got any questions about this. And if you need to try to define this, or if you've got any kind of understanding. Anybody's got anything that they'd like to put into it?
You're looking for a specific, like, childhood memory.
In anything that brings up, you know, along these lines. If you've got, you know, memories that you think are nostalgic, or if you think you don't know what it means, but you've got a nostalgia feeling, you know, you can throw it out there and we can talk about it.
What's the difference between nostalgia and just looking back at the past?
Well, it's got an emotional element. Looking back at the past can be, you know, very, very dry.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what we're trying to define. Is it like that for you? You didn't say it was.
Dry, you mean?
No, I mean, you didn't put a mood on it.
No. But I find, it's probably been studied, as you get older, you go back more, you remember mm-hmm. things of the past, and that it is true. And it's very, I spend a lot of time, I don't want to, back in nostalgia.
Yeah.
Going over what happened before.
Yeah, I think that we do that when we get older. We start looking back, trying to, you know, review all of this stuff.
I think your memory, you forget, it gets... So that you can't remember what's going on now, you go back.
It's yeah, you can't remember what happened yesterday, but you can remember what happened when you were
right.
A kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that started happening to me. That's why I started getting into this. So I think Luke mentioned it a little bit, that it was at some point a few years ago, I remembered that I used to go out in the backyard and lay down under the trees and look up at the trees. It was so awesomely beautiful that I couldn't take, you know, what was going on. So I wanted to take pictures of it. Well, it didn't work, you know. I look at the picture and it was just a picture of a tree. What the hell is going on? I couldn't transfer it. The mood wasn't in the picture. The mood was in me. You know, you see this with sunsets, you know, or anything that's an object of beauty. If you see a beautiful sunset, that's not out there. That's in you, or you wouldn't know it was beautiful. You're relating it back to an emotional part of yourself. I mean, when I was little, I could do that, you know. And, you know, I think when we're little too, and before we get into the dualistic mind too much, we can pick up on things directly. And nostalgic mood can bring us back to that ability to be able to do that. When I was a little kid, my mother was administrator of a mental health clinic, and she used to bring me in for, you know, cheap child care and just let me run around. And I would go back into the doctor's offices where the psychiatrists were. And even when they weren't there, I could go into the room and I knew what they were like. I could feel it. And I could feel what this guy was like who sits behind this desk. And then they were basically nuts. Not in a bad way, but they just weren't really all that together. And You know, how do we lose that? You know, how could I pick that up just by hanging around this guy's desk? And I knew what this guy's basic state of mind was. You know, the funny things about this. You know, you get nostalgic. One way to explain it too is my maternal grandmother was nuts, and I mean, she was nuts in kind of a bad way, but I didn't know that consciously because I was told she was, you know, this wonderful person. And when I was around her during the day, I thought, you know, she's a little senile, a little nutty, but, you know, she's sweet. But I would have recurring dreams all the time about going over to her house, and it was haunted and it was horrible. And I finally realized that I was being told a story that wasn't the truth about what was going on, but this dreams were trying to get that back to me directly. So how do we lose track of that ability? I mean, we've all got it. It's just that we smothered it over with junk, you know. We're in a hurry. We got to get the food on the table. We got to keep our image up. You know, Bob's got to be Bob. You know, he can't be running around, you know, picking up people's states of mind when they walk in the room. So that, does this stuff, how do we lose this? Can we remember it?
I think one way that you can lose it is, I know in my case, traumatic event can kind of stop you in your tracks, so to speak. So that traumatic event, kind of like once I look back and it's sort of hard for me to go back in my childhood because that sort of was a defining moment in a sense.
Wow.
It kind of stopped me in my tracks right then and there.
Stopped it right.
It's hard to go past that to see what, you know, that innocence or that
right,
childhood
so
mental state was like.
It was like that.
Yeah.
Somebody in the Denver group said the same thing. They said they could remember the exact moment it stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Where
but I can't remember before that, though. I mean, it's not like I just remember to that event.
Yeah.
And in my childhood, I don't remember, like, you know, the freedom and the, you know, the openness. And I don't remember. I mean, theoretically, I know that that was,
yeah,
that was the case. But I don't have a sense of it.
Yeah, he could remember that before the traumatic event, that he had absolutely no worries. Everything was carefree and happened spontaneously. You know, he said it was like he used to go play baseball and there was absolutely nothing that was wrong. Everything was wonderful before that. Before it changed. For me, it didn't happen in one fell swoop. It was kind of more like a gradual darkening over. I mean, you know, Rose used to talk a lot about the direct mind ability, you know, to be able to pick things up directly. And in a certain way, I think that is not as much losing it from trauma as I was taught that I couldn't do it. You know, that no, you can't do that. We don't do that. You know, we put on a smile and act like everybody's okay. And we don't, you know, admit, you know, that people have a shadow. You know, I was very well taught that by my mother in terms of, you know, no matter what's going on in your life, you get up every day and go out there as if nothing ever happened. So pretty soon you're like, you know.
There's something I can throw out which may stimulate some thinking, because what you say reminds me, you know, the idea of heaven is like a metaphor for, I guess, maybe the deepest nostalgia. I'm thinking also of great works of childhood literature, like the Chronicles of Narnia or Winnie the Pooh.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of those works, the characters all return to a beautiful, wonderful place,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that, for me, that was a way of rediscovering what I eventually realized was inside.
Yeah, that's like with the, you know, Lord of the Rings, all the elves get on the boats and go back to the land where there's no arch, you know, I'll get out of here. You know, and then, you know, taking that to a real personal level, but it's not on the level of the imagination, you know, is possible. You know, there is a possibility of It's all finding something that's not dualistic. You know, Rose used to talk a lot about the causal dimension, where, you know, if you want the ice cream, eat the ice cream. And so, you know, wonder, what the heck is he talking about with this causal dimension? And how, if you got there, how would you ever find your way back? In the nostalgic mood, it can be a link back to that. It's like we get lost, like Bob Sergal's saying, you know, we've got, everybody is doing exactly what they really want to do. And people just don't want to hear that. You know, oh, I've got this horrible life. I'm not doing what I want to do. Well, you sure about that, you know, in terms of that? A lot of people are very much in love with being victims. You know, I used to love that. You know, look at all the bad, horrible things that have happened to me. You know, and then you look back on them, you realize they weren't that bad at all. But you got your sense of identity out of it. And you could cling to it.
Do you have any tips or tricks that you utilize when you're having some sort of a realization to keep the ego or the mind grabbing onto it? Like, you know, you're in the middle of this realization and everything is going smooth and suddenly, you know, it comes and grabs. Any tips to, like, you know, get through that grabbing unsteady?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. When you're doing it by as if it's the first time every time, it's got to be an act of the attention. You've got to actually, it's like finding nostalgia. It's an act of the attention. You put your attention on it. You don't remember this in terms of a mental gyration. What you're talking about is exactly it. You have a mental realization, and then the attention goes from the realization up into the mind and starts spinning it. And you spin it in a way that pumps up the identity. It's me doing it, which is not true, but that's how you spin it. So it has to be that freshness to it. It's like meditating has to be, you know, you have to do it every time you do it as if it's the original first time. Keep that direct connection to it rather than the inference of it running through the ego and then claiming credit for it.
So keep giving nostalgia enough value and attention as if it was the first time you're realizing that or experiencing whatever you're being nostalgic about.
Mm-hmm.
So that keeps your attention rather
yeah.
than a derivative of. So nostalgia doesn't end up becoming a trigger for something that mind wants to grab on, but you can stay within the nostalgia.
Yeah, the nostalgia move for me, if you can hold on to it without trying to have reactions to it. That means you can put your attention on it without letting the reactive mind get in the way. And we got an automatic response that the reactive mind jumps in there, and like with Tess's thing, we get lost. You know, we're not looking at it anymore, we're just thinking about it.
And some therapists or some writers on spiritual topics have said about maintaining childhood hobbies if you're still drawn to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm 61 years old, but I've recently, the last 2 years, I've gotten into flying rubber model airplanes. You know, you line them up and they fly for a minute or something, they land. It's really cool. It's fun. But for some reason, I like doing that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a funny thing. Yeah, it's like getting back into photography. You know, I dropped it for 34 years because I had this big ego that said, I can't do photography because photography is something that takes away from me enjoying the moment. You know, when I'm out in the wilderness, I have to enjoy it directly. You know, I'm going to be here now. You know, and I'm not going to take pictures, you know, because that takes me out of the moment, you know. And then it occurred to me, you know, this is really stupid. You know, I want to take pictures because I want to take this here and share it with the people that I know can't go there. So that to me was a lot of work. which was nice to rationalize my way out of. And it dawned on me too that you're in the moment when you're taking the picture. You know, you can't put these things in boxes. You know? So just do what you want to do. You know, if you want to fly airplanes or you want to take pictures, you know, those little things, we inhibit ourselves so incredibly that we take all the fun out of it. You know, that was something that happened to me when my first marriage, when I was drinking a lot. And we went down to visit family in Louisiana, and we went to the beach. And we were out on the beach on a little raft, paddling around in the raft, and you know, we were having fun out there, and my wife looks over at me and goes, "You're smiling." And I went, "Well, of course I'm smiling." You know, and she was like, "You haven't smiled in months." But I didn't know it. I had no idea. You know, I was so inhibited and so serious and so miserable that I didn't know what I was like. All I knew was that I was tied up in a knot, but I couldn't even admit it. You know, where's the childhood, loss of that? You know, what happened to the kid? You know, here I was being, you know, Mr. Serious, and there was really nothing I was doing that was serious anyway. I was just drinking. It gets funny that way. I can see that look is still familiar. I can still feel it, you know, that being way too serious. And sometimes I can see it in people, especially related to their jobs, you know. And you can see they get a certain look on their face, you know, when they're worried about work. It's like you put this death mask on. Yeah, that was one thing I really appreciated about Rose. I think Sergal's got you got that little ho, 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 ho laugh down. I've almost forgotten about that. Yeah, I was talking with somebody, I think it was Steve Hornish, and we were talking about what was Rose doing. You know, I was asking, what was he like when, you know, he was younger? Because I didn't know him until, I only met him like just a few years before he started losing it. So I didn't know what the guy was like when he was young. He said, "Well, for one thing, he just used to like to have fun." And I was like, "Rose liked to have fun? I don't remember that part of him." But boy, when you do that laugh, I can relate to it. You know, to that fun, uninhibited part, the way he could sit there and tell stories, you know, and get everybody in the room just cracked up. You know, when I went to see him, I thought he's going to be this big, serious Zen master guy. And I couldn't believe he'd be sitting there talking about things that were pretty embarrassing in a lot of ways. And he'd talk about the local West Virginia folk and some of their habits. It was like, oh my God. But you could see the childhood elf in him would pop out once in a while. That used to happen when I was in high school. We were an Explorer Scouts, and we would take canoe trips. And this one guy used to say every time we'd come around the corner and there'd be a nice little meadow up on the bank, and he'd say, "Man, I want to have me a little cabin up there and a little woman. We'd have a great time." He would get so nostalgic, like you're saying, this thought that something wasn't even there yet. You know, what the heck is that? What's that peaceful... You know, look of the cabin in the woods. You know, or the next valley. You know, wanting to see what's over the hill. You know, what's over there. And for me, that's kind of a link back to. I think it's got its physical side to it. I think a lot of it is, you know, trying to get us to go, reproduce and multiply. You know, get the cabin, get the wife and the baby. in there, but it also the it leads back to a sense of everything's okay. There's an eternality where there's not a problem. We're not bouncing back and forth between the dualistic opposites. And I think that reminds us of that. You know, that there's somewhere that where everything's simple and there's not a problem with it. You know, that was one of the things that I noticed after my realization was that it was not an exaltation as much as it was everything was okay. You know, before I was flipped back and forth between being a narcissist and a masochist. You know what I mean? It was like, I had a dream that said you're either the king or the king's valet. And what I saw was a king on the throne with a guy shining his boots. And you know, why do I have to be one or the other? You know, there's no hope in this. And then it was like, everything's okay. I can be the guy in the cabin. I don't have to worry anymore about, you know, trying to uphold some, strange fantasy. But that's true. That's got such a draw to it.
You may have answered this. What's the difference between nostalgia and longing?
I think they're the same thing. It's just two different words. It depends on how you define them, you know, but I think they're the same thing. I think nostalgia just is the word that stuck with me. You know, longing is the same thing. You know? I mean, it's an emotional link back to something that doesn't necessarily have a thought pattern around it. It's a pure emotional thread.
So if I longed for my mother, it would be more of a longing for that maternal, what she gave to me?
You'd have to find that out. Yeah. Yeah. Look at it and see what is it that you long for in her? What was it? Was it the way you were, the way she was?
One of the strongest senses of nostalgia I've ever felt was when I saw photos of trees, sun shining through tree limbs, the trees overhanging rivers in Central Florida.
Wow.
I'd never seen it in real life before. When I saw that, I had the feeling I'd been there before and I wanted to go back.
I wanted to go back to it. Yeah. That's the way the desert around Utah is in some sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to be, just take my breath away, I couldn't stand it. And it was so strong, and it was just something about that rock. Mm-hmm. I remember you talking too about brick walls.
Yeah.
Would do that for you.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sun shining on brick.
Yeah.
Walls. Mm-hmm.
You know, and who knows? You can take this off in fantasy land if you want. You can say, oh, in my other reincarnation, back when I was the Pharaoh, I used to. You know, I used to live in the desert, so I'm remembering back when me and Cleopatra were running around, you know, whatever. But you know, that's if you do that thing you were talking about, and instead of this being a pure longing memory, and you start, you know, letting the spin get a hold of it. Yeah, it's that word eternality pops up for me all the time with that. You're looking at something that's more eternal, or you could say that's more, I hate to use this term, but oneness, you know.
Those mountains know how to exist.
Yeah, it's there, it's solid. You know, it's It's got that feel to it.
Do you have any thoughts or do you have any experiences on what you could call archetypes?
Oh, sure, yeah. It you know, in I can get off on archetypes for a while, you know, because of the of my we talk about this in the Denver group quite a bit, but the one that pops up all the time is the puer.
What?
The puer eternus, which is Latin for the eternal boy, which has a good and a bad side to it. But, you know, and archetypes can be very useful and they can be very dangerous. I think Bernadette Roberts said that she thought she saw more spiritual people get hung up on the level of the archetypes than just about anywhere else. They could get into that and not get out. You know, you see this in New Age groups with people get into the goddess and the whatever, and then they're gone. They can't work their way back out of that. But they can influence you for sure, just the way that nostalgia can. I know an archetypical mood or image can get a hold of you. You know, and there's a ton of them. You know, you usually have the eternal boy, which is the little kid that doesn't want to grow up. Now, there's a good side and a bad side to that. The good side is that can be your, Maurice Nicole called him the intermediary. You can use it to get in touch with eternity because it can see both ways. But you can get stuck in it in a way by letting your, taking it literally and not wanting to grow up. And usually a kid who's got the puer in him will be overly attached to the mother. He doesn't have to grow up. His mommy's going to take care of him, or he'll go marry mommy, you know, which is pretty much what I did. You know, you know, and that way you don't have to grow up. You can get hung up, and you're not using the puer as something you're conscious of. You're trapped in it. It's gotcha. You can't separate out. You know, there's a saying about narcissists. What is it? They can't see the problem because they are the problem. And so, you know, if you're in it, the archetype, you have no idea. You think it's you. That can be very sticky.
So I'm having some difficulty figuring what use this is at all. This nostalgia thing. It's like, oh well, it's like I can look back and I can reminisce. And, oh wow, that was interesting. Oh, I wish I still had that. Oh, I wish I didn't, or what have you, or that happened that way, and still,
sure.
I could have this thing, this fantasy in the future. But what's the use of it? Except, okay, there's an inner longing, and then maybe that's all there is to take away from it. There's this inner longing for it.
It's a way to find yourself through that duality of emotions, like desire and fear. You know, I want this, I'm scared of that. Those things are driving you, whether you want them to or not. So what's an emotional thing that isn't like that, that doesn't keep you stuck in here? Can you find that nostalgia, that longing, which is the third force?
Find the true longing.
What's real? What's eternal? Mm-hmm. Who am I? It's the emotional who am I. Instead of, you know, just the thinking through it and going, well, I'm not that and I'm not this, but well, is there an emotional side to that? You know, what am I? Where did I come from? Can you try and find your way back there, not only with thought, but with emotion? And nostalgia is a way to do that. You know, it might take a while. You know, my emotions were so goofed up for years, I couldn't make sense out of them. And then whenever I would try to tie into emotions, then I would just end up weeping because there was so much stuff in there. And then when I'd open the door just a little bit, here it would come, you know, come boiling out. So it took a while to get over that. It was like a guy told me, you know, this is like looking at your emotions is like opening a bottle of champagne. You know, you don't want to just pull the cork out and have it spew all over the room. Take a look down in there real quiet like and let the pressure off easy.
So what practice, you know, in terms of using that as a tool, nostalgia as a tool, what practice do you think do you suggest? Like be in that feeling being in that mood for a long time, does that mean cancer?
Being able to relate to it. Can you relate the feeling of nostalgia to something in you? Can you find it? Can you see where is it pointing? And for me, it's a direction. Like I said, it's a GPS. It's like, where is it pointing? You know, if it, it to me, it, it eventually, if you follow nostalgia back in a pure sense, it's going to lead you down in to the center of the heart. It's going to lead you home in a sense. It's a sure bet compared to dualistic ways of thinking, you know, or dualistic ways of feeling. So, you know, if you can follow it, it's not necessarily something you have to sit down and do, but I mean, look at what do you want to do with your life, you know? Does it lead you to anything? You know, it's like very, we can be very funny about things like that and not know what we're really wanting to do. Like what Bob happened to him, I remember sitting in your cabin there on the farm and you said, I want to have a family. I remember going, oh my God. You know, I knew you were right. You know, it's like, yeah, wow, but it's so weird, you know. You're doing on the farm what I thought was the thing to do, and here you are saying you want to leave and go have a family back there. And I'm like, what the hell? But I knew you had some kind of a feeling about it, that was where you needed to go. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, they lead us around in strange directions. I think we need to cross-check this all the time, you know, to keep us out of error. You know, we've got emotion and rationality, which can feeling and thinking, and one check the other so we don't get completely flopped off on all sides. You know, I mean, my God, I've been liable for that all my life, you know. I'm getting into the feeling, and all of a sudden I'm married and moving out of state, you know. It's like, how the heck did that happen? You know, was I, you know, putting thinking up against that? You know, thinking about things never occurred to me very much until recently. You know? Mm-hmm. It was always just, you know, feel your way through things, and rationality has no place in it. You know, I think I was taught when I was little that rationality was used to rationalize. You know, it was its only function, so I just gave up on it. That's what Paul Connor said at one time. He said, what my wife calls thinking, I call rationalizing.
Well, two ways I think you can go into that mode from my experience. One is visiting your childhood place, like wherever you grew up. When you visit there, when I used to do it, I used to get a big longing kind of feeling when I go there, like where I grew up. That was one good thing, like, you know, that nostalgic feeling was very strong. The other is, like, we talked about this sometime back in the TAP meetings, listening to old songs.
Mm-hmm.
That brings intense feeling, nostalgic feeling, right? What do you think about that?
I think it's very powerful. I mean, that's how they used to get the kids to go off to war. You know, they go around with the bagpipes and recruit them, you know, to join up to the army because they'd hear that nostalgic thing and, oh, I got to go fight for the homeland, you know, and save, you know, God and country. So it's very powerful. You know, I mean, I was talking to Eric early about falling in love. You know, I mean, what the heck? I used to couldn't see my way out of that at all. You know, infatuation. You know, I mean, he asked me at a TAP meeting, he said, do you believe in love or something like that? And I was like, I had never questioned it, you know, in the least bit. You know, to me, it just took you over and, you know, off you go. You know? But it's very powerful. I think that's why I think nostalgia can be, because it can lead you, you have to use reason to back it up in a certain sense. I mean, is this reasonable? Am I going off to, you know, to fight the enemy and die for a feeling? You know, that's a little bit different than looking to try and find out who you are. You know?
That movie, Little Big Man, have you seen that? Little Big Man, that pipes, that's like the drone instrument throughout the long movie. Because whenever the armies are on the march or the battles are about to begin, or they're, you know, transitioning from one saga to the next, and yet they can hear these bagpipes in the background with them.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Join up with the Scottish Highlanders. Here we go. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Are there any practices that you either used yourself or come across that you think can be helpful?
You mean in one nostalgic vein or just in general?
In general.
Just in general? Well, I think, there's a ton of things. You know, I think the main thing for me, which got me in a mess, was one reason I couldn't do rational thinking was because I had no energy. I was what Rose used to call a dish rag. You know, I mean, good grief. You know, I couldn't think of Einstein. Like I was saying to that thing, by the time I got to, you know, out of high school and college, I was a mess. So I think that one of the biggest things we can do is to learn how to save your energy. I said something to Mark about turning off the taps, like Rose used to say. Very hard for us to go find new energy. You know, you can't just go down and buy it. You know, so what are you going to do? You got to get what you got and get it turned in the right direction. Take it from, you know, spending it unwisely and start investing it in the search. You know, for one thing, this is a big self-discovery trip if you start doing this, because if you start going against yourself and trying to save your energy, there's going to be a battle, and you're going to find out real quick, you know, what your commitments are. You know, it's like, I think Rose might have said it, if you want to find out who you are and where your values lie, try being celibate for 6 months. You know, you might get a big wake-up call as to what your real values are. You know, you'll be tested. And you find out, you know, what's really going on. If you can take your energy and get it out of the things where you're wasting it, then it generates more intuition. The energy can go into something higher if you've got that intention. I think it was Muji who said that intention creates tension. So if you put the intention, I'm going to save my energy, you're going to automatically see resistance. And so you get to know yourself a little better. You get to figure it out. You know, I got figured out something that was real important. When I came to the farm, I thought I was all serious and had it all figured out. And I'm going to be here and I know what I want to do and blah, blah, blah. And after spending time on the farm, it eventually came to me that I was there to hide. I came to the farm because I was scared to death of life emotionally, and if I could stay around this guy, Richard Rose, I'd be safe. He'd keep the boogeyman away, you know. And there was nothing much to do. You know, let's hang out on the farm, we're going to meditate, and we're going to all go off to Nirvana, and it's going to be wonderful, you know, and I don't have to work or nothing. And, you know, that was a huge shock to see that, because I was oblivious to it pretty much. You know? I was operating in it. You know, I was operating from fear. I didn't know that I had fear. So, you know, just doing something like that showed me that. You know, and another thing is just taking a chance, you know, finding out making a move. I think it is really important. You know, coming here, that's a wonderful thing to make a move to, you know, just to come do this. I've heard some people say that they, you know, didn't want to maybe come or not come, and they couldn't decide, and they show up. Just make a move and get out of your rut. You know, do something different. Fly airplanes or something. You know, get out of that rut of your thinking and seeing something will come through. But I think the main thing is for me, it was just getting your energy back. You know, and that's a personal thing, too. You've got to know where you're spending it. You know, where are you putting it and where are your priorities? I think, and Sean had a great statement about if you're not keeping a journal, you're a fool. And I think that you find out where you're spending your energy real quick. If you keep a dream journal or an active journal, you'll figure it out. I used to just be shocked at it. I'd look back at it and go, oh my God. God, I'm the most negative guy there is. All I do is bitch. And it occurred to me one time when I was out in the desert, it just floored me that I got this big realization that you are basically negative. And I never thought that about myself. I thought I was a positive, good guy. You know? And I realized I'm basically negative. You know, I don't smile. What the heck, you know? And I was putting energy into being negative. It's a funny thing too, you know, I noticed this in the Denver group, is you can just get the guys to get some people to act and take a little bit of movement, and it generates more movement, and pretty soon then they're actually doing something. But it's so hard to get people to make that first move, especially in group work, you know, to get people out of it. People want to think they can do it on their own. I had a guy write me an email not too long ago, and he said, I think you're a sincere guy, and I want to get together with you one-on-one. And let's talk, you know. So I got a habit of this from getting burned. I Google him, you know. And I found his picture and what he did. And I looked at his picture and went, this guy's trouble, you know. That was my first take on it. So I wrote him back, and I said, why don't you come to one of our meetings first, you know, before we meet one-on-one. And he got really mad. He wrote back and said, I am not interested in meetings or groups or meetups or any of that stuff. Goodbye. Whoa, you know, but it, you know, he was not going to make a move. He wanted this to, you know, I'm going to be the big shot and meet with you one on one and tell you what you're going to tell me. You know? You know, but so how are you going to break out of something like that, you know, and get a little freedom, you know, get into a group like this, and then you've got to get out of your head. You know, you're forced to act on it. I can remember one of the most amazing things that happened to me at one point was, I didn't know this, but I think this is wrapped up in being extremely self-centered. You know, we're all in that in some fashion. But seeing that other people were real, that just dawned on me one time, and I was like, oh my God. You know, there's actually people out there. Holy shit. I never knew these people were there. You know, they were just things in the landscape, and you use them or abuse them, and they do the same to you, and you just mow your way through there, you know. But, oh my God, that's a person. Wow. And I think I could only see that because I could finally see that I was a person. You know? I'd never taken myself, you know, in a real way. That to me was a big emotional, you know, breakthrough. It made everything so much easier all of a sudden.
Bob, you made this point about, paraphrasing now, that you think that at least 90% suffering to carry it through, and you know, using the longing, which sounds kind of sweet, and you talked about pure consciousness and heart, but you contrasted it with 10% curiosity. I can't relate to either of those.
Really?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, the longing, which is, I'm using that word, is an affliction. It's powerful. And I can't relate it to suffering. And it's certainly, curiosity sounds like a pretty weak word for it.
Yeah.
It's a Thich Nhat Hanh's arrow in the shoulder.
What?
Yeah.
The arrow in the shoulder. Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, you got a koan, it's like a time bomb.
I mean,
at some point, something's bothering
you. But this comes
you.
Up
super
over and over, not just at TAP, but in other forums too, that there's sort of these two. And I can't relate to relate to them. Curiosity just sounds like.
Well, sure.
I agree that couldn't carry it through.
Yeah, I can't. Curiosity part to me didn't play that much. You know, it's useful, but it sure didn't give me the motivation to get out of bed. You know, but this nostalgia to me can be very painful. It was very painful for me for a long time. It was painful because it showed me how far off base I was. How big a mess I was, and how I was lost in a false idea of myself. So sure, that brought up a lot of suffering that I had to go through. You know, I mean, it was years of that. Oh my God, who the heck is this nut? You know, how did I get like this?
But is it hard for you to imagine? Not without the suffering that you've talked about, the alcoholism and the other things that you've talked about, is it hard for you to imagine that the longing could be, the word I use for it is an affliction,
with a
lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like an implant.
Yeah.
That's the way I've talked about it sometimes, that you didn't ask for, and... But it's there, and it's a drive. It's powerful.
Yeah, use it. Use it. You know, we got to use these things. You know, you use these things as goads. You know, we won't do this work unless we're like fanatical and being pushed at it. I can't imagine anybody doing this work in any kind of way that isn't really miserable or really curious. You're just not going to get out of your shell, and we're just not going to do it. It's the old Gurdjieffian Kundabuffer, you know, that they would talk about. They had to put an implant in us to keep us from killing ourselves. Because we actually knew what was really going on. You know, we wouldn't put up with it. You know, which is the truth, you know. We found out what was really happening here. You know, like they say, if you actually could see very clearly, very suddenly, you know, it can drive you mad. So, be thankful that we've got time. You know. And push it all out in a row, rather.
Simplify because I think everybody suffers.
No, but your longing didn't grow.
But I don't think that was the. I don't know what it was, but I don't think it was from suffering. I think this was something in me that. Again, I caught that some teachers have criticized this. They said it's a blessing, but for me, it has felt like an affliction.
Mm.
Maybe it's a blessing too, but it.
Well, we've run out of time, so let's take our break now. If anybody's got any questions, I'll be here all weekend, so we can always talk about it later on. And it's great to see everybody here, especially the new people. Really good to see them.